An editorial note before we get started. In a previous episode, I made a comment that some of you may have misconstrued. Many of my episodes go a little long, and I end up editing them for length, which is what I did in this previous episode. The problem is that when I edited out some of my own remarks, in the process, I removed the context from one of my statements. To many of you listening, it may have sounded as if I was saying that City Manager Eric Walsh treated city council members differently. That is neither what I said nor what I meant. What got left on the editing room floor was the other individual I was referencing and not City Manager Eric Walsh. My apologies for any confusion. Now, on with today's episode. It's 2025, and San Antonio is celebrating a new year, a new speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, and a new campaign to be the next mayor. Our topics for today are what the new speaker means for San Antonio and what the new financial disclosure forms say about the mayoral candidates. Joining me today are Shea Bluntzer, a longtime in-house lobbyist for NuStar Energy, who has recently ventured out on his own and launched Marlin Blue Strategists, a full-service, Texas-based public affairs firm providing strategic, legislative, and regulatory representation. And DeMonte Alexander, the founder and CEO of Citizen Reach, a public engagement and community outreach firm. Alexander also serves as Director of Public Affairs for the Bridgewater Consulting Group, a full-service management consulting company that works exclusively with clients in the utilities industry. From the podcast studio at Lano Realty Partners, here now are Shea Bluntzer and DeMonte Alexander. It's great to have both of you here. You've both undergone some changes. DeMonte, you founded and serve as the CEO of Citizen Reach, a public engagement firm.
Correct.
And also, most recently, you've joined Bridgewater Consulting. So tell us about those two entities and what you're doing with those entities.
So Citizen Reach basically comes from a culmination of all the things that I've done over the years in terms of government, community outreach, public affairs. After consulting with a few colleagues, mentors, and really wanting to get into the government affairs lobbying space, we realized we have a lot of lobbyists and government affairs folks here, and the need, the gap in the community is more in the public engagement space. And so that's what we focused on. That's what Citizen Reach will be focused on, is really public engagement, helping NGOs, cities, developers, architect firms, when they want to build things, helping them with, along with the community, find consensus, build consensus, to move some of these projects forward to help the community.
Well, I'm excited to see you go and grow. And you've always been very active in the community, and I'm glad to see you continuing to do so in this new capacity.
Yeah, thank you. I just feel like it's a natural fit for me. If you open me up, you'll see I'm a connector. That's who I am to the core. I love connecting people to places, people to things, people to other people. And it's just what I do best, which is what leads me to Bridgewater Consulting Group. So Bridgewater is a management and consulting firm, mainly for utilities. CPS Energy is a client of ours, but we do that across the country. And so we try to go in and find ways to help them with strategy. How are they thinking about the grid, their grids, and how they move forward? The oncoming of AI and things like that, we try to provide that consultation to those entities. But more importantly, and when you meet Mark, he's more about wanting to understand the community first. Who is this community? Who are the players in this community? And how can Bridgewater be in support of that community? And then after that, we figure out how we can help grow jobs in terms of an economic development standpoint.
We look forward to seeing Mark in the community and his work through you. So again, very excited for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Shea, you've been in this community a long time. You spent many years with NuStar Energy. Recently, post-merger, you decided to hang out the shingle with Marlin Blue Strategies. So tell us about that.
Yeah, thank you again, Eddie, for being here. Appreciate it. Marlin Blue Strategies is the realization of a dream that I've always had, and that was to hang my own shingle and have my own government relations and lobbying firm. Having run government relations and public affairs for NuStar Energy for nearly 20 years under the leadership of Bill Greehy and Mary Rose Brown and Joanna Weedman, I think I got a really good education there, and I'm able to take the skill sets from that organization and those individuals and put them into a firm that I'm very proud of. Again, we offer government relations services primarily in the energy sector. A lot of my clients look a lot like a public utility or a private company in the energy space. I do have clients in transportation, goods movements, agriculture, as well as one that I've continued to help since post-merger, but had started helping since their inception, and that's Haven for Hope right here in Bexar County. Mr. Greehy gave me other tasks as assigned, and those tasks involved helping Haven for Hope. It's something I'm very proud of. They do great work down there, and so I'm happy to continue to help them as well.
You know, you talked about the leadership that helped you and mentored you. Bill Greehy's a stalwart, a pillar of the community. Mary Rose Brown as well, very strong, sharp, independent woman who sadly we lost a few months ago. And Joanna Wiedemann, who is a part of that team as well, who's now over at the Greater San Antonio Chamber. So I know you consider yourself fortunate to have been surrounded with that kind of star power.
Unbelievably lucky, without a doubt. Especially having been able to work alongside and observe Mr. Greehy as long as I was able to. I think everybody in this community owes him a debt of gratitude. His mark has been left on San Antonio in a very meaningful way, primarily in the philanthropic world. He continues to be very active in his foundation that many people in this community have benefited from and without even realizing it. And so very, very thankful for his involvement.
I guess two things stick out in my mind of his doing. One is all the things he's done for St. Mary's University. And the second is Haven for Hope. He carried the torch for Haven for Hope for years and years.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a vision that he had that he put his time, treasure, and talent into in a very meaningful way. But that's who Mr. Greehy is. When he's in to something, he's all in. I know that there's so many different organizations within this community that has benefited from him. Again, we just owe him such a tremendous debt of gratitude. DeMonte, I know that you are involved with an organization that has seen some of the benefits from his generosity.
Absolutely. You know, when we were nobodies, you know, wanting to do something good for the community, especially for the kids who are local graduating seniors who've been accepted by universities. A lot of them, these are first time going to college. And we wanted to put together a charity golf tournament, and, you know, friends reached out, and he was so helpful with us as far as the rate that he charged us. I mean, I think we had the lowest, you know, fee at the quarry, you know, for a charity golf tournament. And I was just so grateful for that. He didn't know me, you know, but he understood what we were doing, and he really appreciated, you know, really appreciated him stepping in that way. So, yeah, speak to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And Eddie, you mentioned, we both mentioned Mary Rose Brown, and sadly, she did pass not long ago. I can't say enough about her and how wonderful she has been to me personally and professionally. A lot of the reasons that Mr. Greehy has been so successful over the years was in large part to Mary Rose and her influence. Her fingerprint is all over this community in a number of different ways, from the Alamo Dome to nearly every charitable organization. She has played a meaningful role in helping, and she's a pro. She's the best. I miss her. I think about her daily. She's has just been a tremendous resource to me in my life, and miss her dearly.
Well, San Antonio as a community is better off having had the philanthropic and business and civic leadership from all of these people. So we do owe them a lot of gratitude, a lot of thanks. You know, you two have been involved in politics in a variety of ways. So I want to, before we get to city politics, I want to talk about the reason that we delayed this podcast in order to be able to talk about what happened in Austin with the election of the speaker's race. And Shay, I'll go back to you to see, did it play out the way you were expecting it to play out?
I think so. I think that there was a playbook employed by Joe Strauss many years ago that was revisited in this speaker's race. And to set the stage for it, you really have to go back to last year. There were a couple votes that really set the stage to where we ended up with the speaker being elected, Dustin Burroughs, the Lubbock Republican. Will Tarantino it? Well, we know what the end result is, and we'll go back. And it really did start with the momentum that were Republican members, especially in the House under former Speaker Dade Phelan's leadership, were somewhat forced to make two votes. Number one was the impeachment of Attorney General Ken Paxton. He was ultimately acquitted in the Senate, and but that was a very difficult vote for Republicans in the House to have to make to move that impeachment forward. I think that the Attorney General remembered that and exacted as much recourse as was available for him politically, and it showed up in the primaries, I think.
Including going on tour to support David Cook for Speaker. And then from a primary standpoint, you know, DeMonte, the example that comes to my mind is Steve Allison.
Right, Rep. Steve Allison, who voted lockstep with Governor Abbott from day one. And he gets sideways on one issue, and you see the results of that.
Where he was defeated in the primary by Mark LaHood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the impeachment was a challenging and difficult vote for Republicans. The other issue that took center stage that kind of led us to where we're at now is that of the school choice and the vouchers vote. Under former Speaker Dade Phelan's leadership, there was not an appetite to move those proposals that were the priority of the governor and the lieutenant governor. So we saw four special sessions where nothing was done in the House, and the House rejected those proposals. And so the lieutenant governor and the governor were not shy during those debates and letting members know that if you're not with us on this, we will remember this during primary season. And they made good on that promise. And what we saw effectively was a stacking of the deck to get that policy, the school choice policy, over the threshold in order to get passage to get it to the governor's desk to be signed. And so effectively what you saw was that built momentum for the far right. And so they felt like they had the votes to ultimately get what they've always prized, and that would be one of their own being elected Speaker of the House. And so they put their candidate forward, David Cook, very conservative member.
Who ironically voted for impeachment.
Indeed, as well as Dustin Burroughs as well, is my understanding. And so if you put the two candidates next to each other, I like to say it was like the Spider-Man meme of two Spider-Men pointing at each other. There's virtually no daylight between David Cook and Dustin Burroughs. They're both very conservative members of the Texas House. And then Dustin Burroughs brought his candidacy forward, which was more so of the establishment wing of the party. And so I think the way that Dustin eventually positioned himself in that was that he reminded people, we are the House of Representatives. We are a very proud institution. We are not only elected members of the House of Representatives, we are protectors of the House of Representatives. And so do you want some other unknown entity, whether it be a large Republican donor or a group of Republican donors influencing the way that we conduct our business, or do you want one of our own? Do you want somebody that's been in the House to lead us? I think Democrats really like that.
And I think historically, most of the speakers have followed the mantra of, I'm going to allow the will of the House to work. In other words, they weren't going to interject their own personal politics into how the House was run.
Yeah, I agree. And ultimately, that was the cornerstone of Dustin's campaign amongst his colleagues. And like I said, I think Democrats really like that. I think some more experienced Republican lawmakers who've been around the block, who have had some fights with the Senate, I think they like that. And so ultimately, the fireworks weren't there on day one that some people expected or wanted to see. Dustin Burroughs prevailed. There was an overwhelming amount of Democrats that with some Republican lawmakers helped elect him become the next speaker. And so he's got his work cut out for him, but I think he's up for the challenge.
I just think, you know, speaking to that, I think that's what people want to see. We want to see collaboration. We want to see that type of cooperation between our legislative officials. And I love the speech that he made. It's just, it made even me as a Democrat feel that, okay, you know, there's a space for a voice for us too. There's someone who's listening to the needs that we have, although it's a conservative agenda, but we still have a seat at the table. And that was important. that was important to hear.
I couldn't agree with that more, DeMonte. That's one thing that maybe, you know, we're a deep red state here in Texas and people maybe forget. Democrats matter, especially when it comes to the House of Representatives. Their voice was heard, and ultimately I think that they were a key component of influencing who our Speaker of the House is. Representative Burroughs, Speaker Burroughs, rather, is a good collaborator. He's been involved. He's very experienced. And I think that he's going to allow the Democrats to have their voice. And
even chairmanships, from what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Well, and let's, if you want to talk about Democrats, he just hired Tracy King, former state rep from the Uvalde, Laredo area, to be on his team to help him with the House, with fellow members. And sharp guy, but, you know, has always been sort of like Ryan Guillen before Ryan switched parties, has always been a conservative Democrat because of the district that he represents. Tracy.
Yeah. I mean, you don't get more experienced of a lawmaker than Tracy King. There's no doubt about that. And he is obviously a terrific hire and knows the House very well. He's one of those defenders and protectors of the House. Great hire by Dustin. I expect that to be the tone that this speaker sets for this upcoming legislative session, one of collaboration.
So speaking of collaboration, you know, DeMonte, last year, then Chairman Burroughs was on this podcast here in San Antonio. He had just recently passed the Texas Regulatory Consistency Act, which is called by its critics the Death Star Bill. Some call it the Stay in Your Lane Bill. The local business community here in San Antonio was getting tired of the city council saying, hey, you need to give a paid sick leave to all your employees. Hey, you need to give them a water break every hour on the hour. And so there was some friction between city officials and city leaders and Chairman Burroughs on that bill. So how do you see that playing out? We're going to have a new mayor and we're going to have some new council members. And now the author of that bill is the Speaker of the Texas House. So
strange bedfellows, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So most people may or may not know that San Antonio, by the Texas, the Constitution, San Antonio is a home rule city. And what that means is San Antonio is allowed to create ordinances and laws that benefit the needs for the community. I think what comes with that sometimes, and it's almost like how you manage energy grids, like real time, what's too far, what's not enough. And I think that it's kind of difficult because when you look at the basic nuts and bolts things that the city municipalities should do and what states should, they kind of intersect. But I think sometimes when you go a little bit too far, even outside of the state, what the state is even allowing, we get in a little bit of trouble. I think this next mayor, which is so interesting, because we have Rolando Pablos, who's obviously a Republican. And when you think about that and you think about the synergies that would happen from that seat to the governor's office and the amount of communication and resources and things that would flow down to San Antonio, you could see that being a very, very beneficial thing for San Antonio. Not an endorsement of Rolando or anything like that. I mean, I think a Democrat or someone who's more progressive could also take that approach to being a more collaborative and supportive leadership style, like a Howard Peak, right? Or even a Nelson Wolf said, hey, look, I'll take 10% if that's what they're going to give me, right? So I think it's going to be important for this next mayor to have a quiet confidence about them, to have a collaborative spirit, and someone who's able to really understand what's important for San Antonio. We need to think bigger. But I think it's going to take someone definitely with a collaborative spirit and someone who's willing to work across the aisle and be a bridge builder, if you will.
I did have a member of the city council ask me after the November elections, how do we repair relationships with the Republican leadership in Austin? So I think this is going to be, Shay, I think it's going to be a critical issue for the new mayor and council.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's no secret that we've lacked that kind of relationship as a city with state leadership. I think that there are a number of different things to point to where we could serve San Antonio better if we had a better relationship. I think one of the things that is apparent at this time is San Antonio is under a lot of construction right now from in its infrastructure, roadways. And maybe that was years of neglect. Maybe that was years of not having the appropriate relationships with the state leadership. And then all of a sudden, one of San Antonio's own, Bruce Bug, becomes the chairman of the Texas Department of Transportation, working in collaboration with former County Commissioner Kevin Wolf. We started to see a lot of investments come to San Antonio, and they're all kind of hitting at the same time, which is why we're going through some growing pains. I think that the case could be made that you can point to that relationship of one of San Antonio's elected officials, local elected officials working with leadership in the state for the betterment of San Antonio. That's just one example, but it certainly doesn't help if you have your city leadership thumbing your nose at the state leadership, at the governor, at the lieutenant governor, who are incredibly powerful individuals for our state who can direct important investments back to our community, not only through government spending, but also through economic development opportunities. I know that the governor is approached by businesses daily about wanting to either move here, relocate, make investments in Texas. Texas is open for business. It's a great place to be. San Antonio kind of gets left off that list. I think with better leadership, more focused on the economic development aspect of utilizing a good relationship with the governor's office can really help move this community forward.
And I will add this. I don't want this to seem like it's just an R next to your name that could create positive change. You don't have to be that. You just have to be someone that's willing to stay focused on the community, what the overall community needs. And when I say community, I mean business community as well, right? Being able to listen, understand what the agendas are, what the vision is from the state level, and then try to find some wins in there somewhere for the community. And so I don't want to make this seem like it's a partisan thing that would benefit San Antonio greatly. I also told, I think, Christina this a while back.
My wife, Christina.
Yeah, you're Christina. Yeah. Just because you're pro-business doesn't mean you don't care about people. And I think that's been a narrative that we've had in this community for quite a bit. I think if we can find that unicorn that understands that we need businesses to thrive here in San Antonio, but also has compassion and genuine care for social issues and things like that, I think that's a good look on San Antonio. And so I'm hoping that we can find that type of leadership. And that's because that's who I am at my core. You know, I'm in more of an independent these days. I am very conservative when it comes to fiscal responsibility, but my heartstrings is on social issues and being compassionate and taking care of people. And it doesn't mean that two things can exist at the same time. We don't have to have this or that.
You know, and you bring up a great point, DeMonte, that I think deserves to be revisited. These aren't partisan issues. This is about the betterment of our community. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. We had a Democrat in local leadership here for decades in Nelson Wolf, who was a tremendous resource for our community. And he, it appears, was principled and led with what's good for San Antonio.
Absolutely.
And
it doesn't matter who's in the chair.
Exactly.
In Austin or who's in the governor's mansion, it's can we get something done for San Antonio?
And having served in Austin, I think that he understood the value and from his perspective in having a good relationship with Austin and why that was so important. Nelson Wolf did that job and did it really, really well. And I think that's what the voters are looking for in this next election cycle is somebody with that perspective.
Absolutely. He was the first campaign that I had the privilege of working on. And when I saw his email list, they were extensive, but he had the same amount of number of people on Republicans for Nelson and Democrats for Nelson. I've never seen that ever before. And it was just incredible to see the amount of support he had across both aisles. It was amazing.
Today's episode is proudly sponsored by Llano Realty Partners. It's a San Antonio-based commercial real estate brokerage that combines the intimate local expertise of a boutique brokerage with the advanced capabilities of a modern national brokerage to provide clients with a superior level of service. With a team of experienced professionals, Llano Realty Partners is dedicated to delivering efficient results and exceeding the expectations of its clients. For more information, go to llanorealty.com. That's llanorealty.com.
So I want to transition to local politics. January 14th was the opening day of the session. January 15th was the first day to file for city offices, city council and mayor in particular. We have four open seats on the council, and obviously the mayor's race is an open race. How hard, DeMonte, will it be to get things done in the early stages after this new council comes together because they haven't gelled, their relationships haven't really formulated
right.
yet?
As someone who served in two offices there, one as communication director, other as deputy chief of staff, I can tell you there's a huge learning curve. No matter how many degrees you have, doctor's degrees, it takes a little bit of time to understand what your ceilings and floors are in terms of what your capabilities are. So I always say that, you know, while everyone else is running, the veterans, you're tying your shoes while everyone else is off. And so it takes a while. What I always recommend to new elected officials is to make sure you surround yourself around a great team, people who've done this before, people who are experts in their respective areas, whether you're hiring journalists who actually work for the paper or for one of the major news outlets.
And know where the landmines are.
Right. And also, you know, policy advisors that have worked in these offices before, even if you have to pluck somebody from the state. That's going to help you move a lot faster than if you hired your campaign team to now, hey, I can't pay you during the campaign, but I'll give you a job. We see a lot of that, but we also see the ramifications of doing that. Sometimes you get a home run, but for the most part, just because they're great on the campaign doesn't mean they're good at policy and advising. And so I think it's going to be important for them to find some cohesion and to gel, go out and do things together, go out and do a retreat, go bowling. I mean, it sounds funny, but really building cohesion really helps when you have to kind of really make some tough, difficult decisions. But we've seen this before a few years ago when we had, I think first time ever, we had five women join. I
mean, that was
a big shakeup as well. And I think they've kind of found their footing. And you talk about collaboration with Jalen and Mark White, you can see a little bit of that.
They're from opposite ends of the right. political spectrum, but they have a very unique relationship. They speak regularly,
right.
and they look for ways to be able to work together, and they have a common respect.
And I think, I don't know if this was Kelton that mentioned this in your last podcast, or is your brother James, even though San Antonio is considered nonpartisan, people choose based on your beliefs, your values. And I think depending on the makeup of this next body, I think that will also determine how quickly they bond or how well they gel. That's going to be important as well. Some of the same conversations that we're having at the state level, these will be conversations and questions that they get asked on the campaign trail when they knock on doors.
It was both James and Kelton.
Oh, okay.
What James said was, it's a nonpartisan office, but it's not a nonpartisan campaign. And if you think it is, you're fairly naive. The reason is, as you're going block walking, people are going to ask you, what are you going to do about border security? And you explain, well, that's a federal responsibility, not a municipal issue. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But what are you going to do about border security? And then you can't just pass the buck, and it's what James was saying. And then Kelton said, the number one question that you get asked at the door is, are you the Democratic candidate or the Republican candidate? Well, neither. It's a nonpartisan race, and I'm being nonpartisan. Yeah, I know. But are
answer
you the Democrat or the Republican?
So,
yeah, they both mentioned it, and it does become an issue.
Yeah, and especially with San Antonio, and I'll let Shay jump in here, with what we have coming up with VIA, with transportation, what we have with our downtown and Project Marvel, all the things that we have to do, they're going to have to find a way to gel pretty quickly because, I mean, the train doesn't stop. Whoever they are, hope they end up, you know, finding a way to work together to where it benefits the community. Because one thing we always say is you might represent District 8, but you are representing San Antonio. When I go home to Nashville, Tennessee, when they say where you're from, where you live, I don't say, oh, I'm in District 10. I say I'm from San Antonio. And I think that's what council, including the mayor, when they come in, they need to have that kind of mentality that they represent all San Antonians when they're on the dice.
You know, Shay, DeMonte brings up a good point. In a previous episode, Rob Killen talked about that this was one of the best freshman classes that he has seen in a long time. You had Councilwoman Sukkur, Councilwoman Marinelda de Gavito, and then Mark White. all three, they gelled fairly quickly. They bonded. Again, they don't always vote the same way, but they have a very good working relationship and an open line of constant communication.
Yeah, I think that what you've seen over the years, and I think that you're starting to see it as some of these new candidates are starting to get filed for these open seats, especially in the mayor's race, the quality of candidate in the candidate recruitment process is being elevated. We're getting better leaders. We're getting more educated, smarter, passionate people about this community to actually put their name on a ballot and put their families through the challenges of a campaign and get elected and do the work. And so this previous freshman class has really elevated the game. I think the real story right now is that whatever your interests are, whether you're in the business community or what have you, you have a tremendous opportunity to help influence this next council because there are so many open seats. You do have an open seat for the mayor's seat, and you have new term limits. And so this next council and this next mayor is really going to shape our city in a way that probably a council never really has before because they've got more time. They have more time to exact their policies, enact their vision for our city. And that's why I think it's so incredibly important that if you have an interest in city politics, in city elections, now's a really good time to engage to help get these really qualified candidates elected that kind of think like you and the type of people that you want to implement the type of policies you're interested in.
So January 15th wasn't just the first day to file. It's also when the financial contribution and expenditure reports became public. I want to take you back to, DeMonte, you mentioned this, the episode I did with the live audience with Kelton Morgan and my brother James Aldrete. So I want to play you this soundbite from Kelton.
I really think that if you look at the four council people who are running for mayor right now, it is really hard to see where they come up with the financial resources to chart that pathway, to chart that roadmap. I think more likely you're going to see people coming from outside the council that are able to put together the resources to actually make a strong run.
DeMonte, give me your take on what Kelton Morgan had to say there. And this was back in November.
What I took from what Kelton says is that, you know, if you don't raise money, you don't have a campaign. That's the start of everything. I mean, that's the way you pay your consultants, but for your first investment in your sophisticated voter outreach programs, you need those things. There's been a lot of conversation about where the money comes from. As a campaign manager, when I put my hat on, I don't care where the money comes from. I have it. Now I can go reach the voters, hopefully with a team. This is a battle of messages, right? Hopefully with a team, with the right message that ID the right voters that we think resonate with our campaign. And we go talk to them face to face. We hit them on the mail. We call them on the phone. We send them emails on our newsletter list. And so having that money is very helpful to any campaign. The only drawback is that money doesn't always equate to votes because it's not local money. It's different from Mrs. Jones or Mr. Martinez in District 2 that's giving you, you know, $500 or $1,000 for mayor, whatever the case may be. And that you could use that as that's an affirmation of their vote, right? So it's a little bit different. But you can use that outside money to reach a number of voters that you need to.
Yeah, I would say that the common theme that I heard from those clips was money is important. Money, money, money. Now that we've had this initial campaign finance disclosure done, I think you're starting to see a tiering of these candidates, especially in the mayor's race. And there's a theme there that outsiders are outpacing the current city council members who are running for mayor. And the gap is pretty wide there. And I don't know if that is a signal being sent by the donor class, the people who like to contribute to these different campaigns. But it's a pretty clear message that outsiders have a message that's resonating. And that there's a it could be possibly equated to that they want some change down at City Hall. DeMonte, you mentioned they have the money. How do they spend it? There has been some expenditures reported on these financial reports. Is that equating to a higher name ID? I don't know yet. Is it equating to getting those votes out? It's still too early to tell at this point. but money is going to play a factor in every single race across the country, especially in this one.
I will add this as well, is you could also look at it as if, as you're an incumbent, you've been in the seat, what, 6-7 years, you may feel like you don't have to spend that much or raise that much because your name ID is prevalent. You're, you know, so I don't have to. But as a new candidate, someone who's brand new, they sort of have to do that because the community doesn't know me yet. So I have to invest some money up front to make sure that I get at least somewhat par. I'm never going to be par with an incumbent, but I need my name ID out there. So you could see a little bit of the outsiders trying to say, hey, I'm here in this community. I need to do the work up front. By the time January comes around, the ones that started in June or before the new year, now you're starting to see their campaigns. They're not building a campaign. They are already running it. They already have their block walkers. They have their community. They have their staff. And now they're allowed to go into the new year running a machine versus some, you see the expenditure reports, some have spent no money. So here we are the middle of January and they have to start building, right? And it's, you only have a few months to do that. So it's like definitely a timing thing.
So I want to talk about the tiers. So the tiers you're talking about, they are the outsiders, Fernando Pablos, Gino Ortiz Jones, Beto Altamirano, those who have not served on council. They raised the most and they have the most cash on hand. And then the next tier would be the council members, Adriano Rocha Garcia, Melissa Cabello Haverda, and Manny Balayas. I guess the surprise there with them, if I'm not mistaken, I know that John Courage announced first and then he was the first to withdraw from the race back in January of 24. And what I don't remember is whether Beto came in second and then Manny came third, but Manny announced early. So I guess the surprise there was he wound up with $13,000 cash on hand.
Yes, it is a bit of a surprise. And what's interesting, Manny, I think, offers a challenge for all candidates in that he's keeping a lot of people on the sideline. Don't ever count Manny Pelaez out of anything.
Sure.
Ever. Manny is a friend of all of ours. He's a very good campaigner. You know, and to the limit that his ability to limit his own gaffes, I think, is going to play a key role in his success. I think probably some of these other candidates, maybe even the outsiders, would have even had a bigger financial report had Manny not been there. He's keeping people on the sidelines. And maybe some of the funding class that he's targeting still hasn't made their decisions. But it is a bit surprising that he didn't perform as well as maybe expected in this first financial report.
Yeah, I think also don't underestimate Laura Barbarena as well.
Okay.
She's
his chief strategist.
Yes, she has a proven record of getting it done here. So I wouldn't count Manny out either. But I would also throw in that, you know, with Rolando Pablos in the race, that may hurt Manny as well. Because when you look at the districts that they cover, predominantly the north side tends to be more conservative leaning. And you see the level of support that Rolando's receiving, you know, if Rolando's not in the race, could you argue that that goes to Manny? You know what I mean? Especially since Courage is out. And so I would throw that out there too. But yeah, definitely don't count Manny out for sure.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think Rolando entering the race was the big elephant in the room, no pun to the Republican Party. And I think he kind of moved people to move early to try to force him to make a decision. He had been telling people privately this was his intention. There was a question of whether or not he'd do it. And so some people jumped out early and he jumped in with them. And so I agree with you. I think that Rolando's candidacy can be a challenge, you know, especially for these north side candidates, in which Rolando is one, because ultimately if you're to look at Rolando's candidacy on paper, great resume, tremendous resume. If you look at what he's done professionally, personally, philanthropically, from an education standpoint, he's what you want. So on paper, he's a great candidate. It remains to be seen if Rolando's a great campaigner.
Well, I would add as well as San Antonio, this is not a countywide race, but is San Antonio ready to elect a Republican candidate citywide? I think the last representative that I remember was countywide was Susan Parmalo, former sheriff. that was a Republican at that time. I haven't seen one since.
And then I wouldn't call Ivy Taylor a Republican, but she was more conservative than her predecessors.
Right. And so, yeah, that yet to be seen. How is the campaign to what we spoke about earlier is, again, this, let's not make it about partisanship. What's great for San Antonio? And can Rolando and his team convey a message that, hey, just like Speaker Burrows did, right? Hey, I'm here for San Antonio. I'm here to represent everyone. Everyone has a seat at this table. I'm here to represent all interests.
Yeah, and so, you know, if the question is Rolando a good campaigner? He's not been tested. This is his first race. I think he passed a pretty big test with this first financial report, you know, raising the most money there. But can they use that money wisely?
Absolutely.
And all of these campaigns hire incredibly intelligent people to manage these campaigns, to find the voters. Where are the voters? They know where they're at. They know the propensity that they have to vote. And so money is going to play a factor, and it's in this way. They know exactly where the voter is. But if I am targeting a voter and I have $100 and Eddie is targeting a voter and he's got $1,000, he's got 10 times a better chance of reaching that voter.
He can touch them that, seven times.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And so that's where money is going to play a critical role. Can they spend it wisely?
And then if you think of fundraising, it's sort of like when you drop a drop of water into a pool, you see the ripples. You know, the first innermost circle is a family, media family, and then extended family, and then friends, and then colleagues and friends of friends. And so you just keep moving further out. I think the other surprise here was Gina Ortiz Jones. I don't think anyone was surprised by the level of money that she raised, because we knew she had a national fundraising base. But the lion's share of the money did come from out of state. I guess that's bad news from an optics standpoint, but good news from the sense that she still has a lot to tap in locally, and she hasn't really gotten in there yet.
That's a good spin on that, too. I didn't even think about that. But to my point earlier, if I'm managing the campaign, I don't care if it comes from Hawaii or whatever. We have money to spend for this community. To your point about local money, we haven't seen that yet, which that's great for her. My only concern with that race is they haven't spent anything.
She was one of the last to jump in.
Yeah, exactly. But when you look at the cash on hand, obviously that's going to deplete once you start hiring campaign managers, directors. And so that's going to deplete. And then you have to kind of build that out. And so you'll see that kind of dwindle, but we'll run out of time.
Yeah. And, you know, from her candidacy's perspective, I think she kind of has a little bit of a head start. She's been on the ballot. She hasn't been successful. She hasn't been successfully elected.
She's run for Congress twice.
That's right. And so the name ID, I think, is there because she's ran those campaigns. I don't think it's surprising to anybody that out-of-state money is helping fund that campaign. She does. You're exactly right. She's going to have to spend some money. It's not going to have to be on name ID. She's going to spend that money on voters. And so it's going to be really interesting to watch how she proceeds throughout this campaign.
And when we talk about Kelton, like I call him Nostradamus because he keeps predicting these things. But I would say when he talked about starting early, you could see the ones that started early, they suck up all the consultants. They got most of the volunteers. And so when you got the money to spend, now who do you hire? Like you know, the resources become really thin. But obviously you can hire outside of San Antonio. You can go elsewhere to do that. But what comes with that is those individuals really know this community. San Antonio is a very tribal community when it comes to what you mentioned about the potholes, pitfalls, things that if you're going to message for this community, you need to kind of know where those are.
There are landmines in this communities and in this community that you want to stay away from. Does an outside consultant from wherever they are in Pennsylvania or what have you understand that? It remains to be seen.
Yeah, she's a tough campaigner. She's not. I'm sure she's going to fight all the way to the end. So this is going to be interesting as we get closer.
There's no doubt.
Final thoughts on the mayor's race.
Final thoughts on the mayor's race. Similar to what I said before, San Antonio needs a bridge builder. San Antonio needs a quiet, confident leader who's willing to collaborate, who's willing to listen more than they talk and find wins where they can, even if it's 10%, if it's 20%, take it for the sake of the community. And, you know, someone who's willing to manage the nuts and bolts and infrastructure and public works and things like that, those are important. But also we have some big tickets on the table that are considered big ideas. And we need that individual to have a vision and to understand how to manage that and work with the colleagues and getting these things done and less of the infighting.
Your comment reminds me of the adage, 10% of something is better than 100% of nothing.
All day, every day.
Shay, final thoughts.
I think vision is important in this mayoral race. I think it's incredibly important that these candidates share their vision and really understanding what this job is. It is a municipal election for a municipal job. I think that I understand the value of the politics of symbolism. I understand why people do it. It sends a message to a constituency that you want to attract to your campaign. But understand what this job is. I think that everyone in our community wants to be able to play with our children in our front yard without the fear of being attacked by some rabid dogs or, God forbid, stray gunfire. I think that we want to be able to get in our vehicles from any point in town and go enjoy all of the trappings and the amenities of downtown without it taking 45 minutes to get there. I think that we want to enjoy fun areas like the Pearl and the Rim and La Cantera without fear of our cars getting broken into. These, I think, are the things that are important to San Antonio. And that's where you can, as a mayoral candidate and eventually an elected mayor, that's where you can impact people's lives and focusing on those issues. It's not the Paris Climate Accord. It's not some of these larger issues that are not under the purview of our city government. Leave that to the federal government. Leave that to the state government. Leave it to NATO in some of these issues. Understand what this job is. And I think that if you can deliver that message, one that focuses on safety, focuses on infrastructure, focuses on bringing good jobs to San Antonio, I think it'll resonate well with voters.
You've been listening to Shea Blunzer of Marlin Blue Strategists and DeMonte Alexander of the Bridgewater Consulting Group and Citizen Reach. Beyond the Bite is a production of Aldrete Strategic Partners, a full-service public affairs and communications consulting firm. It is edited by Nick Chamberlain of Every Word Media and is sponsored by Llano Realty Partners. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like, share, and subscribe the podcast. And if you've really enjoyed it, we hope we've earned a 5-star rating. Thank you for tuning in, and as always, we thank you for listening.